few years during the Iraqi reconstruction, and his passion is bringing enemies together. And so you can find some hopeful nuggets today, I think, in whatever I don't know what he's going to bring, but it will be something to learn from, I'm sure. Danny.
Thank you for apologizing for me before I even get started. It's neat how there's already some threads. There always seems to be threads through the service. It's always really interesting. Several people have already talked about the continual relevance of sacrifice, even to us. I'm going to try to bring a little bit of that out. Even though we don't have the sacrificial system, right, in our faith, that is still relevant to us. Sacrifice is. And Taran talked about, and so did Madeline, about how, I'm just trying to get this out of my way so I can read. The ambiguity, and that's been kind of a theme over the last several weeks, of our faith, and how it's not, some things aren't always so obvious and clear about how we're supposed to believe about things, and yet God can work through us anyway, and he's still in control. So, and that doesn't matter, actually. So, I'm just going to get started here. So, I have this terrible, annoying habit where as soon as I part ways with, after visiting with someone, or after guests have left our house, I go into review mode of the entire conversation. Maybe not the whole exchange, but I quickly go over the potentially embarrassing or offensive comments I might have made. There's bound to be some way I've put my foot in my mouth, and inevitably my body starts to sweat as I recall a particular remark that I usually regret already as it's halfway out of my mouth. Typically, Eva helps me with this by confirming, for example, yes, that was stupid. They're going to think that you're racist. Or, no, I don't think she completely hates you, but maybe next time you might want to lighten up on the sarcasm. Now, some type of review process is healthy, right? You can't go through life saying and doing whatever pops into your head without ever looking back and reflecting on the effects that your words and actions had. But of course, no one goes through life thinking every waking moment about the eternal repercussions of their deeds. Certainly anyone who did wouldn't be any fun to be around. You want an internal check, some sort of inner moral compass, but you want it balanced by other things that aren't necessarily contradictory or bad. But they would drive behavior in a different direction. For example, we've been doing quite a lot of thinking about the qualities we'd like to see in a pastor of this congregation. And I think most of us would agree that merely having sound doctrine, having all the right theology, but not much else, wouldn't be enough. This is obviously what we would want for a youth pastor. Becky, our children's teacher, is loved by children, not just across this city, but probably throughout most of East Africa, not because she has taught them to recite the four spiritual laws, but because they know she loves them, because she's incredibly talented and entertaining in her storytelling, and because she drugs them with sugar. No, but seriously, Becky is clearly lavishly creative in the way that she relates to our kids, in a way that cold moralizing would not only be insufficient, it would be counterproductive and wrong. so far so obvious. No one needs to be told why legalism is life-quenching. Most of us, when we read the passage in the Gospels about Jesus telling the Pharisees that it's okay to heal someone on the Sabbath, I think we feel it's so obvious who we relate to in that story. It's almost unnecessary. But that's because most of us don't have a visceral connection to the Sabbath that the Pharisees had, or that Jesus and his disciples had, for that matter. Here's that passage in Matthew 12. "Now when he, Jesus, had departed from there, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' That they might accuse him. And he said to them, what man is there among you who has one sheep, that if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath?' Then he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other." We hear that and think of how obvious. Of course you heal the guy's arm if you can. And of course you pull the sheep out of a ditch. But again, that's because the Sabbath isn't that big a deal for us. Yet it's all relative. If you've lived even in secular West Jerusalem for any amount of time, you've probably become conditioned to appreciating and expecting a certain amount of Sabbath day observance. Friday nights and Saturday mornings are exquisitely calm and serene affairs in most places, enough to make you feel a tinge of guilt when turning your car's ignition key for having pierced that serenity. And the first time you witness someone on one of those Sabbath days come screeching recklessly down your street in their car with the music blasting at full volume is the first time you begin to understand the Haredi's urge to cast a dirty diaper at Sabbath offenders. It's all relative. Jesus makes that point in the beginning of that passage when the Pharisees complained that his disciples were picking grain and eating it on the Sabbath. He answers them this way. "But he said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had not known what this means," and here he quotes Hosea 6:6, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." Talk about an ironic verse. "But if you had not known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice." Centuries and generations of Christians have read that verse to mean, "Yeah, stupid Jews, don't you get that God doesn't want your sacrifices and your laws anymore? The law has been replaced with love." But this isn't an either-or equation. It sounds like it is, but that's because we're reading it in English, and in Hebrew this is merely a way of expressing an emphatic point. To say, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice," is one way of saying, "I want mercy that much more than sacrifice." In the original passage in Hosea that Jesus is quoting, you can see from the next line in the couplet that this is the intent. "For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." So does that mean God doesn't want sacrifice but still wants burnt offerings? Obviously, this is hyperbole, exaggeration to make a point. Hosea isn't saying God has canceled the sacrificial system, but he's re-emphasizing that he considers a relationship with him and righteous living a priority. Jesus does this famously elsewhere, where we can all recognize it immediately. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Luke 14:26. He's also clearly talking about sacrifice here, even if it's about a different kind of sacrifice. But again, this is obvious hyperbole, and it still is in any language. The point is, Jesus is saying you are going to have a range of goals and values in your life, and many of them good, but some of them will have to take precedent over others. I think it's clear we're not being instructed to hate our families or even necessarily to abandon them. I think the sacrifice he's asking for is a willingness to give up all, but not in an irresponsible way or under any circumstance. Someone might be called to leave everyone behind to serve among the refugees, but I think we would all question whether that calling was legitimate if we found out that someone's 6- and 4-year-old children had been abandoned in the house alone. Clearly, even a willingness to forsake all, as Jesus indeed calls for, he expects a level-headed, balanced, and compassionate weighing of all the factors that go into making that decision, which is why I think he gives 2 legitimate outcomes in his example of counting the cost of bearing the cross to come after him and be his disciple. What king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. Because there's a third option, the worst of the three, which would be to go to war with your 10,000 against the king with 20,000 without counting the cost ahead of time and getting slaughtered in battle. This worst option is illustrated in the verse just before. Which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he is enough to finish it, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. So on the one hand, he seems to be saying, forsake all, to the point of hating everything else. Those are the phrases that stick out in my memory. When actually his metaphors imply that he's asking for those making a decision to become his disciples not to be rash or drastic, but rather to be fully committed in a way that is deliberate and thoughtful and balanced. Again, this was not an either-or dichotomy. Life is rarely so black and white. This was about grappling with more than one value, all of them good, and prioritizing. And from what I can tell, this is what his approach to the Sabbath seemed to be. He wasn't throwing it out by any means, but he was saying that there are all kinds of instances that trump the Sabbath, and that you shouldn't be rigidly dogmatic about it. That certainly where people were in need, you should be moved by compassion to help them first, no matter how much Sabbath-breaking energy you exert. But imagine what Jesus risked looking like with this type of approach. He could have easily been dubbed some sort of moral relativist practicing situational ethics. What, do you just adjust the Torah to suit your whims? They might have charged. They could have accused him of being fast and loose, flippant even, in his adherence to the biblical precepts. He seemed to be too ready to compromise the rules, too considerate of mere people. It certainly sounded like heresy to a good many. Today, many Christians have a hard time with the opposite. They have a problem with the notion that Jesus did not throw out the Sabbath. Because if he kept the Sabbath, what else did he keep? And what might that mean we are supposed to keep? Everyone knows that there are some laws in the Hebrew Bible that were certainly never canceled, like thou shalt not murder, honor thy father and mother, and tithing, of course. But it starts to get hazy after that. And then some people tend to have an even harder time with it because it relates to the whole question of what is sometimes called the ongoing election of Israel and what Christians believe is the current status of God's relationship with the Jews. If that covenant was meant to be maintained, then in what ways is it still applicable? Some of us have no problem with it at all with this issue. Our theology on this question is crystal clear, and how it exactly relates to modern day politics is even clearer. How is it then that we all have very good friends, fervent and sincere followers of Jesus, all of them, who couldn't be clearer and yet couldn't be more diametrically opposed to each other on this issue? And it doesn't seem to be getting any better. Christians who support Israel and Christians who support Palestinians seem to be growing farther apart. So I was at a conference a few weeks ago with a number of Messianic Jews and Palestinian Christians where we discussed some of our frustrations about this. And one of the proposals has been to see if it would be possible to build a bridging theology. So that would be to identify the things everyone agrees on, then possibly challenge each other in areas where the other side hadn't perhaps considered a truth or a fault, maybe. Then as you fill those gaps or bridge them, you essentially write a new theology. We didn't even begin, but I like the idea. In a way, I think what Jesus is doing with his healing on the Sabbath is a form of bridging theology. He's saying to the Pharisees, yes, keeping the Sabbath is good and right, but you also know how good and important it is to care for the suffering. You can upgrade your theology. You can enhance it to make room for this greater good, this exception. The Pharisees went from suspecting Jesus of harboring designs to desecrate the Sabbath to understanding, assuming they saw the light, that he not only continued to be reverent, but did so in a way that flipped the whole concept of reverence and holiness on its head. To revere the Lord's day, to be holy, meant first of all that you were attentive to the lowly and misfortunate. That he engaged them so intensely in these theological arguments is a sign that he respected them and wanted to win them over in the context they understood. He didn't just do the miracle and say, take it or leave it. What more proof do you need? And so I would like to try to imagine what Jesus would say to both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian argument. And, well, if he were speaking to the Messianic Jews first, I wonder if the conversation might sound a bit like the Sabbath ones. You can heal this relationship. Just lost my place. You can heal this relationship with your Palestinian brothers. You can advocate for extending equal rights for them. Even if you choose to share, exchange, or compromise in land or money or whatever else, none of that would negate or forfeit my covenant with you. In fact, it would only enhance and confirm it. It's acting justly that comes first, and showing magnanimity and acting righteously towards the alien that was always central to your being a light to the nations. Imagine how brightly that light will shine if my children are reconciled and working together jointly. I imagine his conversation with Palestinian Christian side might sound like this. Over the centuries, Christians refused to accept the continuing presence of Jews because they thought it symbolized some deficiency in Christianity itself. How, if Christianity was fully true, did Judaism continue to exist? For you, the quandary has been made all the more vexing to consider how it could possibly have been part of God's plan for so many of you to be made stateless or refugees in wars with Israel. Actually, let me pause right there because, in all honesty, I have no idea what to say. I have no idea what to say to refugees. I feel that way when I meet with Syrian and Iraqi refugees, or certainly when I've met a Holocaust survivor. I have no idea what words of comfort there are to offer, and I certainly don't know how what they're going through is part of God's plan. I've seen enough Christian politicians or prominent pastors have to resign or repent for making grotesque statements like God used Hitler to do anything, fill in the gap there. To pretend to know how and why such immense pain is supernaturally designed has probably only ever done damage there. That said, if anything can be learned from recounting the many horrors that minorities in the Middle East have been through, including Christians and certainly the Jews, Palestinian Christians can see that they're not alone. History may not always be a comfort or a guide like we hope, but it can give us context and a sense of proportions. And in that, often we can find purpose. So if I can resume my hubris and play Jesus again, maybe he would say something like, imagine in a restored community of believers, Messianic Jews and Palestinian Christians, showing the way to peace, proving to the Muslim world that it was only through me, only through nonviolence and through acceptance and loving your enemy, the Jews, that peace could be achieved. Imagine if you can accept that Messianic Jews have unique and legitimate calling. As reconciled brothers and sisters in faith, you can help shape that calling. You both have callings. They are both unique, equally valid and valued, and they are intricately and intertwined. You will grow together, whether acrimoniously or gloriously. The choice is yours. So, of course, I could be wrong about all this. I don't know. But I am more certain about a few things, like the fact that Jesus would engage with everyone. Religious figures, women of the night, foreign military occupation forces, corrupt government bureaucrats, weird cult members, foreigners of all religious and ethnic backgrounds, etc., etc. The point is, he engaged all of these wildly diverse people with the intent to reach them, really understand and be understood by them. He wasn't boycotting anyone because he cared more about relationships than that they got their theology right. The other thing I'm more certain about is that in the same way that we shudder to think of a youth pastor's character or Jesus taking an approach to Sabbath that would be dogmatic and unyielding, we're thrilled by an engagement that is dynamic, compassionate, and inspired. And I think our theology, our approach to restoring relations between these two communities has to be just as adaptive, inclusive, healing, and redemptive.